Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, what's behind the struggles boys are having in school?
And why a progressive podcaster wants the left to, in her words, grow a backbone.
But first, a voter-approved measure that brings around $300 million a year into Arizona's public school system from the state land trust expired last year, as lawmakers and the governor couldn't agree on what to send back to the ballot. They did agree, however, to backfill that money from the state's general fund so schools didn't lose out. But with the state budget picture looking leaner this year, there's renewed talk about asking voters to renew Prop 123. Those conversations, though, still include some of the same debates from last year. There are placeholder measures that have been approved through committees at the legislature, but their futures remain uncertain. My next guest is advocating for a clean referral, basically asking voters to extend the same provisions they did barely in 2016. Danny Seiden is president and CEO of the Arizona Chamber of Commerce and Industry. He joins me. And Danny, it seems less likely that the state will be able to backfill from the general fund this year. So what are the prospects right now for getting something on the ballot this fall?
You're right. The state has a lot of money. People maybe weren't as concerned with this as they should have been. You know, there was a lot of debates about how they wanted to extend Prop 123 over the past few sessions. There's no question that it was a good policy that worked. The attempts to tack other things onto it is what has kind of like slowed it down. And not necessarily bad things, just things that are worthy of their own policy discussions elsewhere. You know, there was a big contingent of Republicans who wanted to make sure that that money that came in from Prop 123 went to teacher pay. They want teachers to get paid more money, and that is noble and supportive. You know, I've got three kids in public schools. The difference between a good year or a bad year is their teacher, and you want them to get paid. Well, I get that completely. However, it's very difficult to do that, not just from the state land trust, but the state level. That's always been a local issue. We've learned the hard way in some of our past policy attempts back when I worked for Governor Ducey, so we know that. So that was kind of an issue. The other is a question around ESAs and charter reforms, mm-hmm. and could we throw that in there as well, which then makes it very complicated. And when you're talking about the land trust, I always have to remind people, even 10 years ago when the state was even more of a budget crisis than we are right now, Prop 123 barely passed. So it's a great idea, but people get very itchy when it comes to the land trust. They care about it. Arizonans are big into conservation. They want to make sure we're good stewards. And so that had slowed it down as well. But now that we find ourselves in this year looking at budget shortfalls and getting worse as it goes on in time, the time is ripe to discuss 123 as a way to close that. Because instantly we're talking about $300 million a year that can go into the K-12 formula that you don't have to backfill out of state budget. And that protects other programs. That protects, you know, DES and developmentally disabled folks. It protects our CTEs, our JTEDs, a lot of these other things, dual enrollment, even education that we've come to love.
Well, so you mentioned some of the policy disagreements and ideas that have been floated. Yeah. There's also, of course, disagreements about how much should be taken out sure. from the land trust. There are disagreements about maybe should the money just go to teachers? Should it also go to support staff and librarians? And I know that you just want sort of a straight Yeah. what we've done, let's do it again. Do you think there's a chance, though, that some of those other ideas could really come back? Or if you're a lawmaker, like, is this your chance to get some of that stuff enacted?
Gosh, again, I feel like the way the courts have interpreted things like single subject, it's very risky to tack on too many different policy discussions around something like Prop 123 and how we distribute the land trust. And again, this is really complicated, and you could do a week-long radio show explaining how our state land trust endowment works. And so to attempt to tack on things that, again, I never want to disparage it. These are worthy discussions. Are we paying our teachers enough? Absolutely not. Could we be doing a better job of how we regulate, you know, charters or how we protect ESAs? Those are all good discussions to be having. But I would advocate doing those separately than with Prop 123. So again, I think history has proven you can do this, you can do it responsibly, and we should all kind of like put aside politics for 1 minute and say this is the right thing to do, protects the state budget, and then we can go fight it out on where that money can go to, where if there has to be cuts where they can go to. But this is responsible, and again, it's what it's there for.
So what have your conversations with lawmakers been like on this? Because as you alluded to, it's both parties that are having disagreements both between them and sort of within themselves about all sorts of different issues. So I'm curious what you're hearing.
Yeah. And, you know, we're not doing a "we told you so" spike the football, because for the last 3 years we've been saying, please just do a simple extension. It's easy. We'll work together on it. Now, because of the budget shortfall, potential budget shortfalls, we don't know the exact amount, right, Mark, because we don't know the full level of what we know as conformity. And is the state going to implement all of the One Big Beautiful Bill from D.C.? And if so, that changes those numbers drastically. But with the budget crisis does breed opportunity. And that opportunity has been to sit down and revisit this very stable, very proven way to help close that budget gap in a way that doesn't force tough or unnecessary cuts. So our conversations with both legislative leadership and the governor's office have been much more positive. And again, we're trying to stay very much in our lane about budget health and clear. There's always the ESA reform discussion that creeps in. There's always the making charters more on a level playing field for them coming in. And again, love those conversations. But on 1, 2, 3, we're staying in our lane.
So while I've got you here, let me ask you about something else in the news, especially given what it is you do for a living.
Love it.
I'm curious what you're hearing from some of your members about the issue of tariffs, especially after last week's Supreme Court decision.
No. Great question. And this is all I'm talking about right now. So with members and elsewhere. But, you know, we've at the chamber, I'll just start off here. We've been very clear from the very beginning, you know, whether you like them, don't like them, tariffs are, in fact, taxes. Americans and companies that do business in America are the ones who pay for it. You know, the people who do the importing, they have to pay it. We have the receipts. We've said that the whole time. Going back to the Supreme Court hearing this case in November, it was clear from oral argument this was the likely outcome, that these tariffs were going to be struck down, that the executive doesn't have the authority to do these types of tariffs. Mm-hmm. So we've been anticipating that. The question is, what do we do going forward? Because this Supreme Court case, I would say it means that we need that clarity and durability of a tariff scheme of how these can be applied so that we have the reliability for things like pricing, for things, you know, when you're making a trade deal, if the president can wake up, you know, one day. The joke used to be, and it was hardly a joke, you know, we're doing an interview right now. By the time this interview is done, the tariff rates could change. And that was happening. It was happening that fast. And that's exciting and fun if you're just making the deal. But here's the thing. Companies are spending billions of dollars to move here or manufacture goods here. They don't plan things out minutes at a time. They don't plan things out, you know, months at a time. It's years. We're talking about billions and billions of dollars. And Arizona is now the number one state in U.S. history for foreign direct investment, whether it's the TSMC, $165 billion and growing. You know, we've got LG, we've got Amcor, we've got all these companies that are making these investments. And, you know, the Netherlands has been here a long time. And our trade numbers, which are coming out this week, I think will reflect some changes in who our top trade partners are. That's all very exciting, but they need certainty. So we're excited for the decision. It backs up the fact there are, in fact, guardrails between the branches of government. However, going forward, we want to see how the president intends to use Section 232, which is something a lot of our members are even involved with. You know, that is a lengthy process. You know, I always compare it, you know, put my prosecutor hat on from the olden days to a grand jury of sorts. Hmm. You're behind doors. You are presenting evidence on whether or not something in your supply chain poses a national security threat. I think on average, those have totaled about 270 days. That, again, that's a long period of time. That is not an instantaneous change. So that in and of itself is a little bit more of a durable and reliable process.
Well, so when you talk about uncertainty, I wonder if in some ways these particular tariffs being struck down raises the specter of more uncertainty for some businesses waiting to see how the president and his administration will respond and what they might do next.
You know, that's fair, although I do feel like the Supreme Court case and the majority opinion is pretty clear that, you know, what the president's authority is under the acts of Congress. So, again, this is a good thing. You'll see this get discussed a lot with Congress. I know there's some committee hearings coming up on potentially switching to like a border adjustment tax. I know that's a plan from Congressman Schweikert, which again changes whether you are at the point of tax on an import or not and what can be deducted. There's a lot that goes into that that's complicated. But what there is now is reliable that the channels of government are protected by our Constitution. The Supreme Court did its job, did it right. If Congress wants to give the president more authority, they can. I think we're pleased with the decision. We look forward to working with the administration and our delegation going forward.
All right. We'll have to leave it there. That is Danny Seiden, President and CEO of the Arizona Chamber of Commerce and Industry. Danny, thanks so much.
Thanks, Mark. Great conversation.
One of the most enduring images from the recent ICE operation in Minneapolis is the face of 5-year-old Liam Ramos. Ramos was photographed being detained by ICE agents in a blue winter hat, wearing a Spider-Man backpack. He was later sent to a detention center in Dilley, Texas. Ramos was ultimately released, but his story added fuel to a growing debate about ICE tactics, in particular, the detention of children and families. The Department of Homeland Security currently operates two facilities where children are being detained, the one in Dilley and another in Karnes County, also in Texas. The facilities are officially called Family Residential Centers, and a new report from ASU's Children's Equity Project examines the impact they're having on kids who are sent there. Dr. Chantel Meek is the executive director of Children's Equity Project and worked on that report. I spoke to her last week, and she told me that ostensibly, these detention facilities are governed by a set of standards.
Promoting basic health and hygiene and, you know, ensuring kids have access to education, letting parents and children have free access to each other and free mobility around the facility, as we've seen and we've heard, where it's unclear if that's actually being followed.
So one of the things that you point out in this report is that even though these sets of standards do exist, there's very little transparency with regard to whether they are adhering to these standards. Why is that transparency so difficult?
Well, in terms of reports that we have received, obviously the media has covered quite a bit of this. It's from lawyers who have been let in, who are required to have contact with, you know, families that they're representing within these centers, or people who have been released from these centers. Obviously, we've had congressional visits. But beyond those reports, there's not a whole lot of transparency or understanding as to what's happening in here. And so why? That's a great question. Should be. I think the other thing I would mention is that because these facilities are detaining children, I think they are required to be licensed by the state. They both happen to be in the state of Texas, the ones that are currently operating. So Texas has its own set of state licensing standards for these places. And as part of that, there's a requirement to have some oversight, some monitoring, some accountability systems in place. Also unclear if that is happening at the state level.
So all of this, of course, is happening against the backdrop of a very serious increase, particularly in the last few months, of the number of children who are currently in detention at these facilities. Give us a sense of what that looks like.
The first set of data kind of came out in October. We saw 425 kids, and the most recent data that we have from January is 1,304 kids.
Three times as many.
And in terms of the number of kids who have cycled through them, I think in some places it is more children that have cycled through them than the entire population in the town where these detention facilities are held.
How much of this practice of detaining children is unique to the Trump administration?
That's a good question. We recently published a report and we included a little bit of a timeline, at least since the year 2001. When we think the first one of these was open under the Bush administration, it was called the Berks Residential Facility, and that one was in Pennsylvania. Another one was open in Texas during the Bush administration. During the Obama administration, there were increase in the number of one unaccompanied children who were coming over the border without a parent or guardian, and then families with really young children. There were huge spikes in that. And during that period of time, they opened a family detention center in New Mexico and then replaced that one with the one that we see now in Dilley, Texas. The same year, they opened the one in Karnes, which was previously a prison for adults. In 2021, the Biden administration closed all three of the ones that were open at the time. And then now it brings us to today in 2025, when the two in Texas were reopened, I believe, in March.
Okay. And what are the current regulations around family separation? Many listeners will probably remember this as one of the biggest scandals of the first Trump administration. You were mentioning the current residential standards that DHS and ICE have established for these facilities, which do call for quote, preserving and promoting family unity. Do we know what that looks like in practice?
What we do know is that in some of these family detention centers, the mother, if there's a mom, the mom and the child get to stay together, and the fathers are often separated into different areas, even if they're still within the same facility.
Let's talk about what we know about the conditions in these facilities and how this is impacting the kids who are detained.
We've seen everything from unsanitary conditions to water that's not clean, food that is not edible, children not getting education as they are entitled to within a whole set of standards, whether that's Texas licensing or ICE's own family residential standards. We saw a measles outbreak, of course, in one of them. And so there's just all of these various reports that are coming out. Children are scared and worried and anxious and depressed. And, you know, there has been research on this. And so we know that there's a whole set of negative outcomes, obviously, and common sense would tell you this as well, if children are detained, that impacts development. And so you see developmental regression, kids who used to be able to do particular things go back. You see bedwetting a lot in kids who had been potty training. You see communication differences of kids who might stop talking. Over the course of the last decade or so, there's been children who have died in DHS and CBP custody. So
12, right? According to the report.
Yep. So I guess we know a lot from what we've heard from non-governmental individuals.
So the fundamental positioning of this report is that these facilities are having terrible impacts on kids. Right. Is there ever a situation in which a child can be humanely detained? You know, if you were designing such a policy, do you have a sense of what that would look like?
So to the first question, is there ever an instance where a child can be humanely detained? I would say no. There have to be other ways. And there are other ways that the government itself has tested that allow for community-based efforts where we're still upholding immigration laws.
So what do those community-based efforts look like?
Yeah. So back in 2016, the U.S. government piloted a new program for families who are seeking asylum at the U.S. border. So again, this particular test case was just for families who are coming in, not for families who are already here. It was called the Family Case Management Program. And instead of detaining families or using ankle monitors when we released them, families were enrolled in this program. It was funded by ICE, and they provided a whole amount of kind of mentorship, services, supports to families to ensure that, you know, they were going through whatever legal process they needed to go through and had the supports they needed. What they found was that they had more than 99% appearance rates at ICE appointments and immigration hearings. And it cost about $38 a day to run it, which compared to the estimate of detention, which is $960 to $1,000 a day for a family of three. So the cost is a no-brainer, right? We're not putting children in jails. And you're still compliant with immigration laws, right? We had like 99% compliance with that. And so there are other ways, right? And this was, again, just for families coming across the border. But why couldn't we build on this model, right, and create something for families who are already here?
Well, I have been speaking with Dr. Chantel Meek, who is the executive director of Children's Equity Project at ASU. Dr. Meek, thank you for this conversation.
Thanks for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, a new podcast aims to harness the energy of progressives in Arizona. We'll hear from the host of Nothing Left Unsaid as it embarks on its second season.
But first, the latest surge in ICE activity has largely targeted migrants, but reports have emerged about Native American tribal citizens being targeted as well. Back in January, a Navajo man named Peter Yazzie was at a gas station in Peoria when he says ICE agents pulled him out of his car. He told ABC 15 about the experience.
Started yelling orders, what to do, and complied with them until Ather was down on the ground and zip-tied. That's when they told me who they were.
Yazzie says he tried to prove he's a U.S. citizen, telling agents he had documents in his car, including his certificate of Indian blood, driver's license, and birth certificate. He was still detained.
In response to these and other reported incidents, Indian Country Today recently reported that Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem sent a letter to tribal leaders calling claims that enrolled tribal citizens are being detained, quote, false.
ICE does not target and will not target Native Americans or any U.S. citizens based on appearance, ethnicity, or community affiliation, she wrote. But that has not put to rest the widespread concern in tribal communities. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio has been tracking this, and he joins us now. Gabe, good morning.
Good morning, Sam.
You heard directly from DHS about this, if I'm not mistaken. What did they tell you?
I spoke with the ICE acting comms director a while back when we first heard about the Letitia Jacobo incident, which was a member of the Salt River Pima Maricopa Indian community who is an Iowa resident who was arrested on charges at their county jail in Polk County. And the person with the exact same name as her was also there, but on an ICE detainer. And there was a confusion mishap, essentially, where basically they thought she may have been subject to deportation because of the same name. And when I reached out to ICE about that incident, they confirmed that we honor tribal IDs, which are the same as federal IDs. And that was what the ICE comms director had told me. In the wake of that, we've seen the incident with Peter Yazzie, as you mentioned, and others that are being swept up in the raids and crackdowns.
So the Navajo Nation has set up a hotline where people can report concerns about potential ICE detainments. Let's listen to a clip of what it sounds like when you call that hotline.
Welcome to the Navajo Nation ORB helpline. For immigration questions, press 1.
And we also have this clip here from Thomas Cody, the executive director of the Navajo Nation Department of Social Services, talking about how they set the hotline up.
A lot of the work that we did from Operation Rainbow Bridge, from the fraud activities, came useful when we got into ICE.
So what's the backstory of this hotline, Gabe?
Sure. So Operation Rainbow Bridge, or ORB, was established in 2023, and it was meant to help basically Navajos who were caught up in another issue that led to indigenous peoples going missing, which was the fraudulent sober living homes and the scandal essentially with access and medical fraud essentially and abuse. And so this was a response to that initially 3 years ago. And essentially when I spoke to Director Thomas Cody, they essentially reactivated that system, but to use it for immigration customs enforcement and to track and document instances where Diné people are being detained and to help provide legal support for those members.
And so all of this that we've been talking about so far, this is happening as the tribes are also facing a backlog in processing requests to get tribal identification cards, correct?
That's right. So there's been a longstanding challenge with some of these IDs, generally speaking, various levels of credibility that are seen. So there are some tribes that are reissuing IDs altogether to everyone because they're updating them, making them more legitimate in the eyes of the government. But also there's the backlog, as you mentioned, and that was an issue of concern to Democratic State Representative Myron Soce, who passed a bill last year that went into effect this January, where Native Americans can, in the state of Arizona, can request a Native American ID designation on a driver's license or an ID. And at that time, when I spoke to him, he said this had nothing to do with ICE. It wasn't on the radar for him, but it was to help essentially with members who couldn't get their IDs like himself.
And I think we actually have a little clip here from Soce talking about that.
I had applied for a tribal ID card myself with Navajo, and I was put on a wait list. And that was 5 years ago. And to this day, I haven't received it yet.
So that was 5 years ago. Wow. And if I'm hearing you right, the implication there is that, you know, if he applied 5 years ago and hasn't been able to get his card yet, and that was before these new concerns about the ICE raids, that's potentially alarming for folks who would feel some urgency about getting a card now to avoid these circumstances we've been talking about.
I think it's a way for this new system, and from ADOT, as of last month, we had over 1,650 requests for the new designation since it went into effect. And as Soce was telling me, those IDs expire within 5 years, at least for Navajo. So if it occurred, if he did get it, it would have already expired by the time he had gotten it within that 5 years window.
Right, right. So he would have to get in line again. And what was that number you just said in the last month?
1,650 within the last month through ADOT, essentially requesting for the new ID designation. And what's interesting also is that Representative Soce was championing the legislation in the states of Utah and New Mexico. Neighboring New Mexico's legislator actually turned down the bill. It killed the bill that would have had the same designation on their IDs across the border.
Wow. Wow. Well, we have just about a minute left here, Gabe. One more layer of complication to add. Secretary Noem, as we mentioned, has called these claims of detention false, but clearly they are being reported. ICE has this online locator tool where you can theoretically search for someone who has been detained. But for tribal members, it's not that simple.
For sure. I think what we saw when I was looking for Letitia Jacobo and also Peter Yazzie was that you have to look for a country of origin, essentially, to find essentially where are these people. And there's no other option but the unknown. But it's not so intuitive for you to think that that would be what you picked. And when I spoke to Letitia Jacobo, she said, where would I be deported to? Because I'm a U.S. citizen and this is all I've known. And she was born here in Arizona from Salt River.
Well, there's obviously a lot to keep an eye on here as this situation develops. That is KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio, who covers Indigenous Affairs for us here at the station. Gabe, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Boys are struggling in school. And my next guess is it's not just in one area, but in many. And he says it's worse for low-income boys. There's also a race gap. And as you might imagine, that's causing problems for those boys as they grow up. Richard Reeves is president of the American Institute for Boys and Men and author of the 2022 book of Boys and Men, Why the Modern Male is Struggling, Why It Matters, and What to Do About It. I spoke with him earlier about the problems boys are facing in the classroom, and we started with in which ways boys are not succeeding in school right now.
Yeah, well, actually, the difficulty is answering that question simply because it's on basically every measure in the education system. There's a gender gap just disfavoring boys. But just maybe to put a couple of data points down, in higher education now, there's a very significant gender gap with men a long way behind women. So on college campuses today, it's about 60-40 female-male in terms of the share, which is a bigger gender gap than we had in the 1970s, actually. It's just the other way around. And that reflects a lot of what's happening in high schools and earlier, of course. It's not I'm not blaming colleges here, although colleges can definitely do better. If we look at high school GPA, the top 10% of students are 2/3 girls, only 1/3 boys. Boys are twice as likely to be diagnosed with a developmental disability, and they're much less likely to be school ready when they actually kind of come in kindergarten. And so we see kind of significant gaps that lead to, you know, by eighth grade, boys are about a grade level behind in English in the average school district. And it's worth saying that these gaps are just much bigger in poorer school districts as well.
I assume this is the kind of thing where there's not like one or two reasons for this, but I'm wondering if in your mind there are a few main reasons why this is happening.
Yeah, there are a few. I think one factor is that boys do develop a little bit later than girls. You see it in the young years where boys just develop language skills, especially it's a little bit later. But then in adolescence, too, you'll see that the boys just develop quite a bit later than girls. And where that particularly plays out is actually less in what social scientists call the cognitive skills, which is more just about processing, what you might think of as traditional intelligence. And it's more around organization, study habits, persistence, attention, and so on. And I'd say two other things pretty briefly. One is that I think the lack of male teachers is a problem. And the last thing is the lack of investment in more hands-on learning styles. I don't mean shop class, but I just mean more applied learning styles, more vocationally oriented learning styles, which definitely seem to favor boys.
Is there a time where you can pinpoint sort of where this started happening, where boys started struggling as much as they are, and girls really sort of overtook their academic achievements?
Well, I think it's much more of that overtaking than it is of a sort of new problem of boys struggling. That for sure, there are various ways in which boys are actually falling back in some places, like even in absolute terms. But this is mostly a story of, if you like, of a race that girls are just now winning in you know, much more easily. They've outstriding, overtaken the boys. And the way I think about this is probably, I think we can see this happening really from the 80s onwards, late 70s, early 80s onwards. And my sense of this is that we should see this rather as revealing something rather than causing or being caused by something. And what I mean by that is that I think that some of these natural advantages that the girls have were always there. And the reason that they didn't show up before is because we didn't encourage girls to advance in education or go to college. We were artificially suppressing girls and women in a way that we weren't boys and men. And as soon as we took those artificial constraints away, I think it was really like taking the brakes off a race car, to be honest.
What are some of the ways out of this? I mean, I understand, I imagine you would say, you know, let's have some more male teachers, especially maybe in elementary and middle school or junior high. But like, what else can be done so that both boys and girls can really thrive in school, which I imagine, and it would seem reasonable, is the main goal, that everybody, every student, regardless of their gender, thrives in school?
Yeah, that's right. And the good thing about the proposals that I've got is that there's no evidence that any of them would be bad for girls. I would certainly say I think we need more male teachers. And to be clear, I think that that's not only because of what I think we'll see, and there's some evidence to suggest we would see in terms of academic outcomes, but it's also just, I think, incredibly important not to send a message to the next generation that teaching is women's work. I think it's important that education isn't coded male or female. There are other things too. Like I think it's certainly worth starting boys in school a bit later if we can afford it and it doesn't put the parents in difficult circumstances in terms of childcare, just to give the boy that extra year or extra few months actually to develop. Definitely more hands-on learning. But there are other things, like even we've seen good evidence in Chicago public schools from the impact of high dose tutoring on math scores, and it's really driven by the results among boys. And so you could imagine introducing, you know, more wide scale kind of tutoring programs, and it could be available to all students. Of course, you wouldn't restrict it to boys, but it would disproportionately benefit boys. And so it turns out that just kind of improving the overall education system would be good for everybody, but it'd be especially good for boys, and therefore hopefully narrow those gender gaps without in any way holding back the progress of girls.
I want to ask about the implications of this. Like, what does it mean, not just for those students, those male students who are struggling in school, but like, what does it mean for society more largely if this number of boys really seem to be struggling in school?
Well, we know that a lot of men, especially young men, you know, are struggling to find their footing in the labor market, in higher education, even in family life in some ways. And one thing we can do about that is to set them up as well as possible through the K-12 education system. And so if we are concerned about the fact that, you know, wages have been flat for working class men in the US for half a century now, then there's a skill answer to that. There's an education answer to that, you know, for sure. If we're worried that we're not seeing couples forming and people having children, and one of the main reasons women give is because they couldn't find someone that they wanted to have kind of kids with. If we're worried about productivity, if we're worried about declining male labor force participation, then one of the things we can do that gets upstream of those challenges facing kind of many young men and men generally, and therefore society as a whole, is to do the very best we can with our education system to equip them for the future. And so, you know, I think there's no need to give up on the areas where we do need to continue to do more for women and girls. And there are many, like getting more women into STEM. I mean, the share of women in tech is going down right now, and we've really made very little progress on that front. For example, the share of women CEOs is still incredibly low. The share of CEOs of Fortune 500 companies is still only 50. And so I gave you lots of stats earlier about the ways in which many of our boys are struggling in school. That doesn't mean there are also many ways in which women continue to face disadvantages in our society. And the challenge for all of us is to be able to do both of those things at once and to think two thoughts at once and actually solve more than one problem at once.
All right. That is Richard Reeves, president of the American Institute for Boys and Men. Richard, thanks so much for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Mark. It was great.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Late last year, I spoke to a political organizer named Z. Cohen Sanchez, who was pitching her organization, National Ground Game, as the, quote, turning point of the left. At the time, Cohen Sanchez offered her theory of the case for how Democrats should reclaim their political influence, to wit, avoid talking about hot-button issues and focus on affordability. But that, of course, is just one idea. And since that conversation, I've been interested in how others on the left are attempting to meet the moment. And to that end, I recently sat down with Abigail Jackson, the digital director at Progress Arizona and the host of the Nothing Left Unsaid podcast. Nothing Left Unsaid is entering its second season, which launches this week, and I wanted to get Jackson's take on why the project feels like the right way to galvanize progressive energy. We began by talking about Jackson's childhood in Sierra Vista. She told me that the major military and border patrol presence there pushed her politics to the left at an early age. She felt that migrants were being routinely abused by authorities, and among other things, she wondered why government resources weren't being funneled into the public education system instead. Jackson was vocal about all of this back in high school. She stuck to her beliefs, she told me, even though it didn't exactly make her popular.
I definitely had some very specific labels that had been thrown on me, particularly during high school, as like the feminist, and you can insert, you know, whatever word of choice after that.
Words we can't say on public radio, but that you could say on the podcast.
Exactly. Which, so yeah, it was definitely not cool. I was very much felt kind of alone there in a lot of my thinking.
Well, one of the reasons I'm interested in this is that things obviously have evolved a bit since President Trump took office for the second time, but there was so much conversation shortly after he was elected and leading up to the inauguration in the early kind of days of his second term about how, quote unquote, uncool being on the left politically had become. And I wonder what you made of that moment. Was that familiar?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, one thing that the right does is they've got kind of like a whole culture behind their side, and we need, like, to them it's very cool to be, you know, dunking on libs and whatever, and we need to show that it's actually cool to have values. It's actually cool to stand up for people. These are the things that make us strong and make our community strong, and actually the ones that are on the right are the weak ones.
Let's talk a little bit about how you're doing that in podcast form. What have you made of the conversation around podcasts and the role they have come to play politically over the last few years? Because I remember in 2016, after Trump was elected the first time, podcasting was very much a bastion of the left. It was very much a place for people to go seek out, you know, what they viewed as sanity. Mm-hmm. And it seems like that has shifted.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that on the right, you know, groups like Turning Point or Joe Rogan, they've been very successful at bringing their ideas into the mainstream. We can see, you know, now all these policies that they have talked about for so long on their podcasts, like taking away healthcare funding to triple ICE's budget, attacking trans kids, things like that. They've really used these mediums like podcasts and brought those to people. I definitely saw an opportunity to talk about things a little more naturally in a less scripted talking point way. I think people want to be entertained. That's obvious. And pop culture is something that we do all day, all the time. Politics is something that some people do some of the time. But these political decisions affect us on the day to day. And it's about making those connections between those things in a way that kind of hooks people and entertains them.
So talk about how you're approaching that challenge on Nothing Left Unsaid.
You know, we talk a lot about politics on Nothing Left Unsaid, but we also talk about culture. We talk about food. We talk about music. We talk about reality TV. And we try to make those connections to what is going on in politics. So, you know, when we're talking about like, oh, this is my favorite coffee shop. Well, it's also important to mention, like, why is coffee so expensive right now? Trump's tariffs have something to do with that.
It feels, Abigail, like you're gesturing at a sort of big idea here, which is that the prescription for the left to communicate with young people in a way that the right has done successfully is to talk to them like people rather than like voters.
Exactly. I mean, people are tired of politics and understandably so. But I think one example of the way that the right is doing this, for example, is the Make America Healthy Again movement. We've got all these, you know, lifestyle, and you can't see my quotation mark, my quotes.
Yes, you're doing scare quotes with your fingers.
But, you know, these lifestyle influencers that are seemingly innocuous and they're talking about how to make this recipe or whatever. But really they're delivering subliminal political messaging. And at times it's not so subliminal, but talking to people like they're people, like being very real about the frustration and the anger that people are feeling. And not being afraid to name things for what they are.
But how do you think about the challenge of doing that when it comes to something like you brought up trans rights? These are things that you also are, you know, unabashedly in favor of on the podcast itself.
I think we're never going to beat the right by pretending to be like the right light and shying away from talking about those things. Like they're gonna say what they want and they're going to say it unapologetically. The last thing that we should do is like cede any ground on those topics. We will literally never win by being the Republicans, but a little better. We need to offer something completely different. And that is really what everyday people want.
I mean, do you think of the mission you have on the podcast as like using the tactics of the right against their own ideology?
I mean, being reasonable has, quote unquote, reasonable hasn't really gotten us anywhere. Democrats have been doing the same thing for the last few decades, and we are in the second year of Trump's second term. His regime is kidnapping five-year-olds from their driveways. They're murdering, you know, nurses and moms in front of our faces, you know, and that's just what they're doing on camera in broad daylight. So the time to kind of dance around these issues is not here, and that's not what people want. People are out in the streets like increasing every single day, standing up against these policies. Democrats kind of hiding behind the same stuff that we have been is not working, and that's why we're here. And we need to be bold, and we can't apologize for that. And definitely the right doesn't. What they're doing is not reasonable. Like, let's be clear.
Last question for you. We were talking a little bit ago about this idea of you having personal experience with being a progressive, not necessarily being cool.
Mm-hmm.
There were times in recent history where in terms of things like, you know, internet clout and stuff like that, it was cool.
Mm-hmm.
Now we've been going through this period where, you know, at least in the aggregate perception of people in power, being woke is, quote unquote, not cool. We hear people in power in Democratic establishment circles saying things like, we need to make being a Democrat cool again. Do you agree with that?
I mean, I think caring about people and standing up for people is always cool and has always been cool. What we have on the right is a bunch of weak bullies, essentially, and they, you know, they're like the mean kids on the playground in the lunchroom, and those people were never cool either. So it's about showcasing the power that we have when we do show up for people, that when we are in community. The feelings of belonging and togetherness that you get when you show up in these spaces that are centered around that is so unlike, I mean, I don't spend a lot of time in right-wing circles, but from what I can see is so unlike their, you know, perception of cool, which feels honestly so empty, so soulless. And to the Democrats that are pushing that narrative too, I say, like, grow a backbone. I don't know. Like, if that's what you're more worried about when you're in elected office, then I think maybe, like, that's not the most important thing.
Well, I've been speaking with Abigail Jackson, who is the digital director at Progress Arizona and the host of the organization's podcast, Nothing Left Unsaid. Abigail, thank you for this conversation.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm seeing here on our rundown that the title of this song is Spinning Away. And as we spin our way out of this Tuesday morning edition of the show, we thank you, as always, for listening. If you want more show in your day, don't forget that you can follow us on Instagram at KJZZTheShow and that you can sign up for our weekly newsletter. It's called Radio Heads. Find it at theshow.kjzz.org. Hope you will join us again tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. For Mark Brody and Lauren Gilger, I'm Sam Dingman. We'll talk to you then.
Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayanna Hamilton. The show was created by John Hoban. Our executive producer is Amy Silverman.